Welcome to this rigorous deep dive into our source material for today.
Thank you. It is a critical subject.
It really is. Our mission here is to examine the architectural, philosophical, and, well, the algorithmic dimensions of privacy.
Right.
Specifically, why you as a human being require privacy to construct a coherent identity.
And paradoxically, why we are currently in an era where we engineer technologies to completely dismantle it.
Exactly. So to map out this journey for you, we are going to dissect two fundamental uses for privacy.
The first being the psychological necessity to simply be someone.
To establish a distinct identity.
Yes. And the second is the absolute necessity of privacy to become someone else, to mutate that identity.
We will also explore the neutralizing effect of constant surveillance.
Yeah.
Analyze how recommendation algorithms process your personally identifying information. And
finally, we have to confront the ultimate trade-off. The teleological, biological benefits of surrendering our data entirely.
Right. So let's start with the architecture of identity. The absolute necessity of concealment.
This is the first primary function of privacy, the requirement to be someone.
To exist as a distinct, recognizable person, you fundamentally require control over the boundaries of your own information.
There is a foundational case study from the early internet in the sources that illustrates this perfectly.
The Ashley Payne case.
Right. She was a young school teacher. She went on a European vacation and engaged in behavior that is entirely common for a young adult.
A photograph was taken of her double-fisting alcohol, a beer in one hand, glass of wine in the other.
And the critical technical detail here is that she placed this image behind what she fully believed was a secure digital boundary.
A private Facebook account.
Exactly. She assumed she had architected a wall around that specific data point.
But she miscalculated the integrity of that early digital architecture.
The photograph breached the parameters of her private network. It circulated well outside her curated audience.
And eventually arrived right into the classroom where her students were learning.
The systemic consequence was absolute.
The school board terminated her.
Right. The institutional judgment declared that she had become a distraction.
Think about the mechanics of that judgment. Her students saw this unfiltered manifestation of her identity and could no longer take her seriously as an academic authority.
The boundary collapse completely destroyed her professional identity in that space.
Which highlights a catastrophic failure of information control.
The only reason she felt the liberty to act as a party woman on her vacation was the operating assumption that she retained absolute sovereignty over her personally identifying information.
Right. She believed she possessed the agency to dictate exactly who would receive this data regarding her location, her activities, and, well, her level of intoxication.
And when you remove that guarantee of secrecy, you observe what sociology and law fundamentally define as the chilling effect.
The chilling effect. If individuals lack control over their personally identifying information, their behavior is preemptively altered.
Think about your own digital footprint.
If Ashley Payne had possessed the foresight to realize her private data would inevitably be rendered public, she would never have experienced the freedom to behave in that manner to begin with.
The looming threat of termination would have neutralized her behavior entirely.
She likely wouldn't have consumed a single drink, or at the very least, would never have allowed a camera within 10 feet of her.
Which brings us to a critical philosophical assertion regarding human nature. Identity requires simultaneous revelation and concealment.
Yes. To exist as a coherent entity to any specific audience, whether that's your students, your family, your colleagues.
You must continuously curate which data points you transmit and which you actively suppress.
There's an excellent grounding illustration of this selective concealment in the source material.
The philosophy professor.
Right. Consider a rigorous philosophy professor who is also a father to young toddlers.
In the domestic sphere, he routinely engages in behavior entirely typical of a parent.
Speaking in complete gibberish. Making absurd, exaggerated noises on the living room floor.
He is revealing a very specific, nurturing facet of his identity to them.
Yet, if he were to suddenly pause a graduate level lecture on ethics to coo and babble at his students,
his academic identity would instantly disintegrate.
He would lose all intellectual credibility. To maintain his identity as a respected professor, he is absolutely obligated to conceal the behaviors that define him as a father.
And there is a sharp, source-grounded irony in the inverse of that equation as well.
Oh, the courtship.
Yes. The professor reveals his rigorous, analytical, philosophical mind to his graduate students, But if he had solely transmitted that specific data stream to his wife.
If he had only ever spoken to her about the strict theoretical dimensions of privacy and ethics during their courtship.
She almost certainly never would have married him.
It's a brilliant demonstration of how constructing a human identity is essentially an act of meticulous data segregation.
You are one person for your children, another for your spouse, and a third for your professional peers.
You cannot actually be any of these specific people without the structural capacity to conceal information from the others.
Privacy is the wall that keeps those identities distinct.
And when that structural capacity for concealment is forcibly removed, we encounter the neutralizing effect of constant observation.
To truly understand the mechanics of this, we have to look at the architectural concept of Jeremy Bentham's panopticon.
Bentham conceptualized the panopticon in the late 18th century as the ultimate physical and architectural expression of discipline.
It is a prison designed with a circular arrangement of backlit cells surrounding a central observation tower.
The inmates in the cells are illuminated and entirely visible at all times.
While the central tower utilizes blinds or tinted glass to remain completely opaque.
So the guards inside the tower can observe any prisoner at any given moment, but the prisoners can never verify if they are currently being watched.
The psychological terror of the panopticon is that the physical presence of the guard eventually becomes entirely irrelevant.
The inmates internalize the observation.
Because they might be watched at any given second, they must continuously and exhaustingly adjust their behavior as if they are being watched.
This induces absolute neutrality. When people operate under the belief that they are subject to constant observation, they cease to do anything extraordinary.
Their behavior flattens completely.
And the source material notes that you can elevate this theoretical concept far beyond a prison guard. The observer in that opaque tower doesn't have to be an agent of the state.
It could be a priest, or even a mother.
If an individual believes their mother might be watching their every move, even the most hardened criminal would default to a state of complete, unexceptional neutrality.
They will not define themselves as specific, distinct individuals. They become a flattened average.
Now, we have to bridge Bentham's physical architecture to our modern digital reality, because we have effectively engineered a digital panopticon.
Constant algorithmic observation operates as that opaque central tower today.
Every digital interaction, every location, ping from your smartphone.
Every biometric fluctuation recorded by your devices is captured.
When you lack privacy in the modern era, you are continuously subjected to this neutralizing effect.
You default to an anodyne, flattened version of yourself because the algorithmic gaze is inescapable.
And you never know exactly when it is assessing you for an insurance rate, a job application, or a credit score.
Exactly.
So if the panopticon effect neutralizes us and keeps us locked into one static, flat identity, what happens when we want to change?
Because human beings are not static creatures.
Which leads us to the second core function of privacy detailed in our sources. The absolute necessity of privacy to become someone else.
Human identity requires mutation.
But to change who we are, we must alter our defining data. Our tastes, our diets, our political beliefs, professional affiliations.
Altering that data safely requires a secure incubator.
A space completely shielded from both the algorithmic gaze and societal observation to experiment.
We see this vividly in the sources' case studies regarding professional mutation.
Take the hypothetical philosophy professor who decides he has completely exhausted his academic calling and suddenly wishes to become a musician.
He wants to take vocal lessons, perhaps even try out for a local musical group.
He requires strict, uncompromising secrecy for this experimentation. Think about the stakes.
If his university colleagues were to discover this pursuit prematurely, they might attend a performance and witness him being utterly absurd on stage.
But far more dangerously, his professional dedication to his academic research would immediately be questioned.
To maintain his standing as an academic while simultaneously exploring a radical career shift, he must conceal his new trajectory until he achieves sufficient success to safely announce the reality.
That hypothetical maps perfectly onto the real-world study of the English and creative writing teacher.
She desired to shift her professional output away from peer-reviewed academic journals and toward fan fiction.
Which, as the source points out, can be highly lucrative, but within the rigid, prestige-obsessed hierarchy of a university environment.
It is generally frowned upon and certainly not taken seriously.
The institutional judgment would have been severe.
So, for her to test this new professional identity safely, she required a mechanism of absolute concealment.
She utilized a false, completely anonymous internet ID to write and publish her fan fiction.
Anonymity operated as the essential incubator. It afforded her the freedom to test the viability of this new identity.
To see if she could actually achieve success and an audience in this alternate domain without jeopardizing her established primary career.
If the experiment failed, the anonymous ID could simply be discarded without any collateral damage to her real name.
If it succeeded, she could then choose to dismantle the boundary, revealing to the world that the successful fan fiction writer and the established academic were the same person.
But this philosophical and psychological need to mutate, to engage in trial and error with our own identities, seems fundamentally incompatible with modern digital infrastructure.
It is entirely incompatible. This is the core algorithmic dilemma we face.
Recommendation algorithms, such as those deployed by Amazon, Netflix, or social media platforms, are explicitly designed to ensure that your historical data is dragged along with you into perpetuity.
The algorithm fundamentally does not recognize your desire for a clean slate.
It continuously models your future behavior based on your accumulated past preferences.
So if identity mutation requires adopting new tastes and discarding old beliefs, the algorithm actively thwarts that organic process by continuously surfacing your old tastes and beliefs.
You are anchored to the person you used to be by an inescapable chain of personally identifying information.
This systemic conflict is the subject of advanced academic research currently emerging from the University of Trento.
Yes, from their law school and computer science departments. They are investigating a concept they term genhumanism.
Sometimes noted in early transcriptions as genhumanism.
Right. It essentially defines the profound struggle of the human condition against this inescapable data permanence.
Let's break that down for the listener. We are talking about the profound friction between a human's organic need to evolve, to leave the past behind, and a database's rigid refusal to ever forget.
That is the exact tension. How can human beings break away from their established personal information?
If your past is constantly weaponized against your future development by recommendation engines that refuse to let you change,
how is true identity mutation even possible in a digitized society?
The researchers propose a legal framework to combat this algorithmic anchor, called the right to discontinuity.
It is conceptually adjacent to the European right to be forgotten, but far broader.
The right to discontinuity argues that human beings fundamentally require legal and systemic mechanisms to intentionally sever themselves from their accumulated past data.
Without the guaranteed systemic ability to render your past data obsolete, the psychological process of becoming someone new is structurally blocked by the database.
You are trapped in the digital panopticon as the person you were 10 years ago.
But if we accept that privacy is just an incubator for change, or a shield against the chilling effect, we run into a crucial typological debate.
What is the exact nature of the value we assign to privacy?
We have to distinguish between intrinsic value and mediated value.
A mediated value is essentially a tool. It is something we desire not for its own sake, but strictly because it facilitates the acquisition of something else.
If we accept the premise we just discussed that privacy is only necessary to be someone or to become someone else, then privacy is strictly a mediated value.
It is merely the mechanical lever you pull to acquire autonomy and enact identity mutation.
But there is a much heavier, compelling argument that privacy possesses intrinsic moral worth, standing completely independent of its utility.
Intrinsic value implies that something is good simply because of what it is.
Think of the concept of human dignity. We desire dignity for its own sake, not as a tool to acquire secondary benefits. It is an inherent good.
The source material illustrates this intrinsic value through a very visceral thought experiment.
Imagine a television camera forcefully invading the private sanctum of your home.
The immediate, profound revulsion you experience in that scenario is not a calculated, logistical response about losing your ability to incubate a new career in fan fiction.
You aren't thinking about the right to discontinuity.
The disturbance is immediate and deeply violating.
That inherent sense of violation strongly suggests that privacy operates as a standalone intrinsic moral good.
We want privacy simply to have privacy, because to be observed without consent is a violation of our humanity.
Yet despite this deep-seated psychological need, despite the absolute necessity of privacy for identity construction and the visceral revulsion we feel at its invasion,
we are currently living through the voluntary surrender of secrecy.
We have to examine the counterargument, the reasons why we actively and enthusiastically do not want privacy.
We willingly surrender our privacy because we have been offered an incredibly potent teleological exchange.
We can examine the true case study of the Apple Watch to to understand the mechanics of this transaction.
This case involves a grandmother whose life was definitively saved by the total eradication of her bodily privacy.
She wore an Apple Watch that maintained continuous real-time surveillance of her biometric data.
It constantly tracked her heart rate, processing her biological telemetry without a single second of interruption.
The algorithm detected a microscopic anomaly in that continuous stream of data.
It identified a critical heartbeat irregularity, instantly processed the severe medical implications, and transmitted an immediate overriding alert,
instructing her to seek emergency medical attention.
Because she surrendered the absolute privacy of her biological state to the continuous monitoring of the algorithm, the anomaly was caught just in time and her life was saved.
This forces us to analyze the situation through the lens of deontology versus teleology.
From a deontological perspective, deontology being the ethical theory that focuses on strict rules and absolute moral duties,
we would argue that a human being possesses an inherent, unalienable right to an unobserved existence.
The continuous, unblinking extraction of biometric data by a corporate entity is a fundamental violation of that absolute moral boundary.
Under strict deontology, the Apple Watch is a privacy catastrophe.
But the technology operates on a purely teleological framework.
Teleology evaluates the morality of an action entirely based on its outcome or its final purpose.
The algorithm redefines privacy. It strips away the philosophical right to secrecy and redefines privacy, technically, as a stream of readable, actionable data points.
And when we look at the outcome, the continuous algorithmic processing prioritized biological survival over personal secrecy. The end result was a saved human life.
And you, as a member of this modern society, are actively consenting to this exact trade every single day.
We are voluntarily surrendering the deontological right to exist unobserved in exchange for the teleological benefits of algorithmic processing.
We allow the database to monitor our location, our sleep cycles, and our heartbeats because the database can predict the heart attack before it happens.
We trade secrecy for survival.
It is the ultimate realization of the digital panopticon, but it has been repurposed.
It is no longer a mechanism of discipline or a neutralizing prison. It has transformed into a mechanism of absolute biological and social optimization.
You have just navigated the razor-thin tightrope that defines the modern human condition.
On one side of this equation, we have the absolute psychological necessity of privacy.
You require secrecy to selectively construct your identity, separating the individual you are with your children from the individual you are with your colleagues.
You require the incubator of anonymity to mutate, to adopt new tastes and professions without being dragged down by the algorithmic anchor of your historical data.
You fundamentally need the right to discontinuity just to remain a dynamic human being.
Yet on the other side of that tightrope lies the undeniable, staggering triumph of absolute algorithmic surveillance.
You are participating in a system where the total eradication of secrecy equates directly to the preservation of life.
You are constantly negotiating this digital architecture, deciding in real time what fragments of your identity you must rigorously conceal to remain human, and what fragments you must surrender to the algorithm to remain safe.
If you were cast with architecting the ultimate foundational algorithm for future human society, which would you encode as the supreme directive? Absolute privacy, ensuring every individual the unalienable right to discontinuity, the freedom to constantly reinvent themselves free from algorithmic memory, or absolute social and biological well-being, a world where all secrecy is eradicated so that no heart attack goes unpredicted, no harm goes unseen, and survival is guaranteed. Which profound loss are you willing to live with?